Brought to you by Charity Mobile, the phone company that supports life and family. 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite charity. Buy the way you believe at charitymobile.com and use promo code TRADITION.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This week, we continue our study of Pope St. Pius X's Pascendi Dominici Gregis, his landmark encyclical released in the first decade of the 20th century. It was his encyclical defining modernism and exposing the errors of the modernists. It is also a dense encyclical. And so instead of doing a full read-through, which I actually have on this channel already from 5 years ago or something, we are taking in small portions. It's much easier to understand in small portions. And today we're going over what St. Pius X had to say about the modernist as historian. What does a modernist understand of the history of the church, of the faith, of the Bible, of the history of human beings in general? All of this focuses their understanding in diabolical ways. And this is this is the source of much of their errors. So here we turn to Pope St. Pius X on the modernist as historian. The modernist as historian and critic. After having studied the modernist as philosopher, believer, and theologian, it now remains for us to consider him as historian, critic, apologist, reformer. Some modernists devoted to historical studies seem to be greatly afraid of being taken for philosophers. About philosophy, they tell you, they know nothing whatever. And in this, they display remarkable astuteness, for they are particularly anxious not to be suspected of being prejudiced in favor of philosophical theories, which would lay them open to the charge of not being objective, to use the word in vogue. And yet the truth is that their history and their criticism are saturated with their philosophy, and that their historical critical conclusions are the natural fruit of their philosophical principles. This will be patent to anybody who reflects. Their three first laws are contained in those three principles of their philosophy already dealt with: the principle of agnosticism, the principle of the transfiguration of things by faith, and the principle which we have called of disfiguration. Let us see what consequences flow from each of them. Agnosticism tells us that history, like every other science, deals entirely with phenomena. The consequence is that God, and every intervention of God in human affairs, is to be relegated to the domain of faith, as belonging to it alone. In things where a double element, the divine and the human, mingles, in Christ, for example, or the church, or the sacraments, or the many other objects of the same kind, a division must be made and the human element assigned to history, while the divine will go to faith. Hence, we have that distinction, so current among the modernists, between the Christ of history and the Christ of faith, between the sacraments of history and the sacraments of faith, and so on. Next, we find that the human element itself, which the historian has to work on, as it appears in the documents, has been, by faith, transfigured. That is to say, raised above its historical conditions. It becomes necessary, therefore, to eliminate also the accretions which faith has added, to assign them to faith itself and to the history of the faith. Thus, when treating of Christ, the historian must set aside all that surpasses man in his natural condition, either according to the psychological conception of him, or according to the place and period of his existence. Finally, by virtue of the third principle, even those things which are not outside the sphere of history, they pass through the crucible, excluding from history and relegating to faith everything which, in their judgment, is not in harmony with what they call the logic of facts and in character with the persons of whom they are predicated. Thus, they will not allow that Christ ever uttered those things which do not seem to be within the capacity of the multitudes that listen to him. Hence, they delete from his real history and transfer to faith all the allegories found in his discourses. Do you inquire as to the criterion they adopt to enable them to make these divisions? The reply is that they argue from the character of the man, from his condition of life, from his education, from the circumstances under which the facts took place. In short, from criteria which, when one considers them well, are purely subjective. Their method is to put themselves into the position and person of Christ, and then attribute to him what they would have done under like circumstances. In this way, absolutely a priori and acting on philosophical principles which they admit they hold, but which they affect to ignore, they proclaim that Christ, according to what they call his real history, was not God and never did anything divine, and that as man he did and said only what they, judging from the time in which they lived, can admit him to have said or done. And as history receives its conclusions, ready-made from philosophy, so too criticism takes its own from history. The critic on the data furnished him by the historian makes two parts of all his documents. Those that remain after the triple elimination above described go to form the real history. The rest is attributed to the history of the faith, or as it is styled, to internal history. For the modernists distinguish very carefully between these two kinds of history, and it is to be noted that they oppose the history of the faith to real history precisely as real. Thus we have a double Christ, a real Christ and a Christ, the one of faith, who never really existed, a Christ who has lived at a given time and in a given place, and a Christ who has never lived outside the pious meditations of the believer. The Christ, for instance, whom we find in the Gospel of St. John, which is pure contemplation from beginning to end. But the dominion of philosophy over history does not end here. Given that division of which we have spoken, of the documents in two parts, the philosopher steps in again with his principle of vital immanence, and shows how everything in the history of the church is to be explained by vital emanation. And since the cause or condition of every vital emanence whatsoever is to be found in some need, it follows that no fact can antedate the need which produced it. Historically, the fact must be posterior to the need. See how the historian works on this principle. He goes over his documents again, whether they be found in the sacred books or elsewhere, draws up from them his lists of the successive needs of the church, whether relating to dogma or liturgy or other matters. Then he hands his list over to the critic. The critic takes in hand the documents dealing with the history of faith and distributes them, period by period, so that they correspond exactly with the lists of needs, always guided by the principle that the narration must follow the facts, as the facts follow the needs. It may at times happen that some parts of the sacred scriptures, such as the epistles themselves, constitute the fact created by the need. Even so, the rule holds that the age of any document can only be determined by the age in which we each need had manifested itself in the church. Further, a distinction must be made between the beginning of a fact and its development, for what is born one day requires time for growth. Hence, the critic must once more go over his documents, ranged as they are through the different ages, and divide them again into two parts, and divide them into two lots, separating those that regard the first stage of the facts from those that deal with their development, and these he must again arrange according to their periods. Then the philosopher must come in again to impose on the historian the obligation of following, in all his studies, the precepts and laws of evolution. It is next for the historian to scrutinize his documents once more, to examine carefully the circumstances and conditions affecting the church through the different periods, the conserving force she has put forth, the needs both internal and external that have stimulated her to progress, the obstacles she has had to encounter, in a word, everything that helps to determine the manner in which the laws of evolution have been fulfilled in her. This done, he finishes his work by drawing up in its broad lines a history of the development of facts. The critic follows, and it fits in the rest of the documents with his sketch. He takes up his pen, and soon the history is made complete. Now we ask here, who is the author of this history? The historian? The critic? Assuredly, neither of these but the philosopher. For beginning to end, everything in it is a priori, and a priori in a way that reeks of heresy. These men are certainly to be pitied, and of them the apostle might well say, they became vain in their thoughts. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. But at the same time, they excite just indignation when they accuse the church of twisting the texts, arranging and confusing them after its own fashion, and for the needs of its cause. In this, they are accusing the church of something for which their own conscience plainly reproaches them. And that was Pope St. Pius X on the modernist as historian and critic. A couple of things worth focusing on there. One, they themselves twist the scriptures and twist history. They reform history. They reinvent history to suit their ends. We see this on the discourse on communion in the hand. An honest look at the history of the faith shows you that only one of the church fathers ever really spoke positively about it, and the others came down against the practice. It was not a widely practiced thing. That is one example. Another thing worth focusing on in Pascendi, at least that section of it, is that the modernist, as a historian, takes the facts of faith they take Christ, and they take the things that he said, and then they divide them between, and they create a, quote, real Christ, real in their own mind, and then a Christ of faith. We'll put that in quotes, too, because it's of faith only in their own mind. The modernist will often deny the resurrection. Not always. There are modernists in our church today who profess their actual resurrection, and they, when they do so in a way that confirms what the church has always said about the resurrection, that it was truly real, not merely symbolic, not a resurrection in the hearts of the apostles, but an actual resurrection of body, blood, soul, and divinity of our blessed Lord. But many of them do deny the resurrection. They say that the resurrection was merely in the hearts and in the minds of the apostles, that that is what happened in the upper room. Many of the modernists will take the things that don't square with their theology that Jesus said and put that into the personal lived experience of the apostles, thus allowing them to negate them if need be, which they often do. And then the Christ of history becomes a mere man, maybe one wiser than the rest of us, maybe one given some divine insight, but that's about it. It's diabolical what modernism is. And it is why it is imperative for us to understand that in the crisis in the church today, Francis isn't the problem. He's just the latest manifestation of it. This is a problem that has been building for decade upon decade upon decade, and every pontiff before him, since the 1950s, has had some role to play in this. Hard to hear for some people, I know. Let me know what you think of this in the comments, please. I will be presenting the next part of Pascendi probably in 2 weeks. As always, pray for the church. I'm Anthony Stein. Ave Maria.